content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello and welcome to Heard Any Good Books Lately? An exclusive program from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is brought to you by the Friends of the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped, an organization of citizens, volunteers, and patrons, all interested in supporting the library and the services it provides. Now, the Friends group was founded in 1989 and now has more than 300 members across North Carolina. If you would like to join the Friends group yourself, we'll have information on how to do that later in the program. This program is all about books, with special emphasis on those available from the North Carolina Library for the Blind. The library has more than 86,000 titles in its collection. Books and magazines are available in large print, braille, and talking books as well, both digital and cassette, mostly digital these days. The library has more than 11,000 patrons across the state. Now, if you're not a patron but are interested in becoming one, I'll have more information at the end of this program. This month, we'll take a look at some of the most popular books checked out during the month of June 2015 at the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped. The first book we will look at today is one called Invisible by the very popular author James Patterson, who wrote this along with David Ellis. And this is a review by Joe Hartlob. Invisible features a somewhat odd and very smart protagonist in the form of Emmy Dockery. When we first meet Dockery, her job as an FBI analyst is in jeopardy, through no fault of her own, as we come to find out, a situation that is not helped by what some would classify as her obsessive and erratic behavior. Dockery's twin sister died tragically in a house fire a year prior to the events in this book. To all appearances, her death was accidental and classified as such. However, there are several minor elements that just don't ring true with Dockery, and she begins researching to see if there have been similar instances where others have died so terribly. As newspaper clippings and copies of internet articles begin to fill the walls of her apartment, Dockery slowly comes to the conclusion that her sister's death was not accidental, but rather is part of a much larger sequence of similar events that have been occurring for years. The problem is that no one will believe her, and for good reason. In virtually every incident, the death-dealing fire has been classified as accidental in nature. Furthermore, in each case, the fire has left the victim's body all but impossible to autopsy. Dockery appears to be grief delusional, even to retired FBI field agent Harold Books Bookman, who was not only a bright star in the agency's firmament, but also her fiancé at one time. When Dockery contacts Books, who ironically enough is running a bookstore in his retirement, he wants nothing to do with her or her theories on both a personal and professional level. Dockery, though, is both obsessive and persistent, and slowly but surely persuades Books that a pattern exists outside of her imagination and that a killer has operated for years with impunity without leaving any clues or discernible pattern, numbering Dockery's sister among his many victims. Now, when Dockery finally obtains frightening and irrefutable evidence that there is a killer among us, the chase is on. Yet knowing that a killer exists and finding him or her are two entirely different things. And as the narrative alternates between an account of Dockery's efforts and the killer's recorded diary, the paths of the FBI analyst and the killer slowly but inexorably intersect toward a final and extremely deadly confrontation from which neither will walk away intact. Patterson and Ellis infuse Invisible with a cinematic feel. I could see it on the big screen in my mind's eye the entire time I was reading it. Thanks to its near-perfect pacing and occasionally quirky but very smart characters, one also learns quite a bit about the aftermath of fire and what it does to a body. As a result, the book is packed with forensic information that is worth the price of admission all by itself. People who study this sort of thing postulate that any number of serial killers are operating under the radar at any particular moment, and this thriller certainly provides fodder for that proposition in an immediate and very frightening way. You may read Invisible on the beach this summer, but you'll leave the light in your hotel room on at night. This article was reviewed by Joe Hartlob in June of 2014. And once again, the book was called Invisible. Let's turn to a very popular book during the month of June at the North Carolina Library for the Blind. It's called The Witness, and it is by the very popular author Sandra Brown. Kendall Deaton pulls herself and her baby out of a wrecked car, and a mixture of courage and fear gets her to the top of a ravine where she flags down help. But she doesn't dare reveal her true identity or that of her amnesiac passenger to the authorities. Instead, she plans her immediate escape. Her perilous flight begins. The best public defender in Prosper, South Carolina, Kendall had stumbled upon the town's chilling secret, and her marriage to one of the town's most powerful men became a living hell. Her only hope for survival is to flee. Now Kendall is a terrified mother trying to save her child's life, a reluctant witness who knows too much about an insidious evil, and a woman who knows too little about her own heart. An interesting story by a very popular author, Sandra Brown, and that one is called The Witness. Now let's look at our next book from the month of June. Here is called Switch, and it's written by Grant McKenzie. Now, Switch is the first novel from a freelance journalist and art lover, originally from Scotland but now living in Canada. The book, set in Portland, Oregon, in the USA, is a novel about exacting revenge. In a dramatic first chapter, Rick Ironwood is shot and killed by Zach Parker under the orders of an unknown man who has threatened to kill Zach's wife and child unless he carries out the murder as ordered. Despite this, as Zach reaches the house where his family is, it explodes in front of him. However, this is the house of Sam White, a part-time actor making money as a security guard at a nearby shopping mall, who reaches home from his night shift to find his house blown up and his family apparently dead. Until he is given a package containing a cell phone and the distorted voice on the other end tells him that his family is safe, but he won't get them back until he delivers $1 million. With nowhere to go, Sam checks into a hotel, noticing that a man in a Mercedes is following him. He slips out of the back window to his room and into the Mercedes before the driver realizes what's happening, believing the driver to be involved in the kidnapping. However, the driver is Zach, who manages to explain to Sam that he knows exactly what he's going through, and his family was kidnapped too. He warns Sam that the kidnapper will ask him to do a range of illegal tasks under the threat of harm to his family, and that he needs to be prepared. Now, gradually, they start to trust each other and try to work out who is targeting them and why. They discover that they were both in the same year at high school, although Zach was a science nerd, eventually becoming a plastic surgeon, and Sam a budding actor. And they were not in the same groups. Is the kidnapper someone from high school who tried and failed to join their group and harbors a long-held grudge? Or does he have some other reason for targeting them? Can they find him and rescue what's left of their families? Meanwhile, the police are also looking into the case and start to come to similar conclusions. The ending is a dramatic one. As Sam waits at a station with the money in exchange for his daughter, leading to a chase through tunnels to find the perpetrators. This is a strong first novel with a tense storyline, the desperation of the men as they try to follow the orders of the kidnappers to keep their families safe, while trying to find out the identity of the kidnapper and effect a rescue is well told, and although at times fairly predictable, there are a few surprises peppered into the storyline. It is an entertaining first novel. And once again, that novel, this book we're talking about, is called Switch by Grant McKenzie, and the review was written by Michelle Peckman in England in January of 2011. Now let's turn to another book that is from an author we hear from quite a bit on this program, John Sanford. And this is a book called Field of Prey, and it's a Lucas Davenport novel. It appears there is no limit to John Sanford's ability to keep new breath and blood flowing into his Lucas Davenport series. Sanford seems to top himself with each new installment. The latest is no exception to that rule. Field of Prey is a time bandit that demands readers sit in one place from the first page to the last. This thriller is set south of the Twin Cities in a rustic environment that conceals a terrible secret created by a pair of vicious thrill killers. Now, Sanford reveals to readers early on the solution to the mystery that Davenport and his team spend the book investigating. Field of Prey begins years ago when a woman is abducted by a motley pair from a diner parking lot in a crossroads town. She manages to effectively turn the tables on one of her abductors, a local oddball named Jack Horn. She is able to immediately contact the police. Horn, though mortally wounded, escapes thanks to the assistance of his partner in crime, Roger Axel, a local businessman. It becomes clear all too quickly that Horn and Axel have been a part of this business for a while. How long and how much becomes clear as the narrative shifts to the present. When a pair of newly entwined lovers, in the aftermath of a tender moment, makes what becomes a grisly discovery on the abandoned farm that is the site of their tryst. A hidden cistern yields a trove of decaying human remains going back over a decade in time. Though Davenport has other pressing cases, from one involving the missing proprietor of a Ponzi scheme to a quartet of geriatric illegal gunrunners, he is assigned to the serial murder investigation because of the attendant publicity and the feeling among the populace, and understandably so, that there is a murderer at large in their midst and that they are all in danger. Indeed, they are correct. Axel runs a hardware store, and while he is regarded as a bit weird, no one is exactly turning him in as a suspected murderer. When someone gets a bit too close to the truth, however, they wind up dead as well. This happens more than once, a situation that does not bring Davenport and his team any closer to solving their mystery. The clock is ticking. The governor is up for re-election and doesn't need an unsolved serial murder case in his state when the voters step behind the curtain. The additional murders certainly aren't helping either. But Davenport has to do, what he has to do, is figure out what the newest victims knew to get themselves murdered. Time is running out, and just when it seems that things couldn't get any worse, one of the officers on the investigation team, a somewhat abrasive yet extremely competent woman with a bit of a history with Virgil Flowers, Davenport's investigator, also goes missing. Now, Davenport has to solve the who part of the mystery quickly before someone else is lost. The answer to that question will put Davenport in mortal danger as well, maybe for the last time. It doesn't get any better than Field of Prey. At this point in the series, Sanford could be phoning in his stories and few people would care. He does care, though, and it shows. My favorite part of the book, says the reviewer, is a little revelation Sanford drops about three-quarters of the way into the story. A bombshell of a surprise that makes perfect sense. Then, of course, there's the rough humor and camaraderie shot through the entire novel, and a tantalizing hint that things may change for Davenport in the near future. This is a series you must be reading if you are not already. And now this is called The Field of Prey, a Lucas Davenport novel by the author John Sanford. We certainly have some good books that we're talking about on this program. My problem with this, maybe it's yours too, is that when you start hearing these stories, you just want to go out and read or listen to every single one of these books. So, give it a try. They're all available from the North Carolina Library for the Blind. Let's move on now. We're going to take a look at a book called The Marriage Pact by Linda Lael Miller, another popular author that we talk about quite a bit on this program. The women of Bliss County are ready to meet the men of their dreams. See how it all begins in this enthralling new series by number one New York Times bestseller author Linda Lael Miller. 10 years ago, Hadley Stevens was 18 and this close to saying I do when Tripp Galloway interrupted her walk down the aisle. Now that she's recovered from her youthful mistake and Tripp's interference, Hadley and her single friends form a marriage pact. She doesn't expect Tripp to meddle with her new plan to find Mr. Wright or to discover that she's more distracted or more attracted to him than ever. Divorced and eager to reconnect with his cowboy roots, Tripp returns to Bliss County to save his ailing father's ranch. He's not looking for another wife, certainly not his best friend's little sister, but he's never been able to forget Hadley. And this time, if she ends up in his arms, he won't be walking away. It's called The Marriage Pact by Linda Lael Miller. Another short summary here about a popular book called Blue Flame by Jill Chalvis and Laura Heisler. Callie Hayes is the hardworking manager of the Blue Flame. Now, that's Arizona's most remote, relaxing guest ranch. Now, she's given everything to the ranch, body, heart, and soul. Three things that go haywire when her sexy employer suddenly shows up. Their intense, stormy past has taught Callie to never mix business with pleasure. But something about Jake is a little bit different now. San Diego firefighter Jack Rawlings knows the ranch he inherited from his father is safe in Callie's capable hands. After being injured in a high-profile rescue, Jake decides to recover in solitude at the Blue Flame. He may have left the fires behind, but he hasn't escaped the heat. Callie is just as hot and irresistible as he remembers. Now coming home doesn't seem like the best idea, as the sparks between Jake and Callie threaten to burn out of control. That's called Blue Flame, and that's the name of a ranch in Arizona. And it's by Jill Chalvis and Laura Heisler. Okay, here's another one that everybody seems to love. Checking it out from the North Carolina Library for the Blind. It's called Personal. It's a Jack Reacher novel, and it's by the popular author Lee Child. It is both difficult and easy to believe that Personal is the 19th book in Lee Child's Jack Reacher series. Reacher achieved iconic status at some point in the remote past, so that Child could probably write a new installment annually by rote. He instead continues to change things up, combining the very familiar aspects of Reacher's character with the unknown elements of his past and the unpredictability of his present. The result is a series that never disappoints and continues to exceed its own standards with each new volume. Personal is told from Reacher's viewpoint in the first person, which, at least to my memory, is rare for this series. The story begins with Reacher in Seattle, a stopping point between A and the eternal point B. He is contacted by his old boss and whisked across the country for a briefing that touches upon his past. It seems that the president of France recently had been making a speech when a sniper took a long-range shot at him. The only thing saving his life was a new type of security glass that stopped the high-powered bullet. The powers that be quickly establish that there are only four people in the world capable of making such a shot. One of them, it develops, has a history with Reacher. When Reacher was an MP, he investigated the murder of a sergeant outside of a bar. He was able to identify the murderer, an expert sniper named John Cott, with more loose screws than Home Depot. Cott was tried and convicted of murder and sentenced to 15 years in prison. He was released a year early and had been living his life quietly in rural Arkansas when he suddenly dropped off the radar. The government believes that he may be setting up for an even bigger target at the G8 summit to be held in London. Reacher, as part of his due diligence, goes to the man's last known address and finds evidence that Cott, one, has been practicing his shooting skills, and two, has not forgotten Reacher, not for a moment. From there, Reacher spends almost the entirety of the remainder of the book as a world beater, which constitutes another change of pace for the series. He and a rookie CIA analyst, the wonderfully named Casey Nice, travel first to Paris to investigate the initial attempt, and then to London, where a combination of world politics and the local underworld makes Reacher's job, preventing the assassination of one or more prominent government leaders by a master sharpshooter, an almost impossible task. The major strength of Personal is the mystery at the heart of the story, which is both explicit and implicit. The explicit portion deals with the issue of where the sniper will be shooting from and his whereabouts up until the time he attempts to carry out his mission. The implicit part is less tangible, though. Something about the entire scenario is bothering Reacher. It takes him a while to get it, but that isn't the point. He discerns that there are a number of seemingly unrelated points of information that don't make sense within the overall picture. When he figures things out, the full nature and extent of what he discovers is still unreeling itself until the end of the book, and while Personal is completely in itself, it sets up a plot point to be resolved in the future, hopefully sooner rather than later. As one has come to expect from Child's past performance, his latest book almost always contains some of his best writing, and Personal is no exception. It includes, among other things, one of the best nicknames, one of the only nicknames, to have been bestowed on Reacher in recent memory, one that is immediately memorable and appropriate on a number of different levels. The reader is also given a travelogue of sorts of Paris and London, two cities with which Child is intimately acquainted and of which he is obviously very fond. Best of all, it contains a few more breadcrumbs, including a somewhat poignant one that revealed the trail leading to Reacher's background, both recent and remote. The apple indeed does not fall far from the tree. If you've never had the pleasure of reading a Reacher novel, Personal is an excellent place to start. The book is Personal, a Jack Reacher novel by the author Lee Child. And that was reviewed by Joe Hartlob, and that was reviewed in September of 2014. You're listening to Heard Any Good Books Lately? From the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Now we'll turn to a book by the very popular mystery writer Mary Higgins Clark. This is called I've Got You Under My Skin. I've Got You Under My Skin is the title of Mary Higgins' latest suspense novel. The narrative opens with a lovely scene of a young father pushing his 3-year-old son Timmy on a swing. Out of nowhere, a man with a gun runs up to the man and shoots him in the head. He falls down dead. The little boy is screaming, "Blue Eyes shot my daddy." Another witness, an elderly woman, heard the killer say, "Timmy, tell your mother that she's next. Then it's your turn." Fast forward 5 years, the boy and his mother live in an apartment around the corner from her father, who is always on the spot to help and keep them safe. As a former policeman, he has good instincts and relies on his intuition. Lori Moran, Timmy's mother, is a television producer of reality shows. Her new idea is to open cold cases that are anywhere from 20 to 30 years old, where we can get the point of view of the people who were closest to the victim. The first case she wants to tackle is that of socialite Betsy Bonner Powell, who was killed at a graduation gala. That was the name millionaire Robert Nicholas Powell called the party he threw for his stepdaughter's college graduation. He included three of her closest friends who were there when Betsy was murdered. All of the girls have been under suspicion for 20 years. Lori contacts Robert, who is in his 70s, but is physically and mentally fit and excited about possibly finding out who killed his beloved wife. He never remarried, although the mother of one of the graduates thinks she can manipulate him into a wedding. The four graduates are skeptical about participating in such an emotional endeavor, but they are offered $50,000 each if they take the bait. Robert believes someone in this small group murdered Betsy, including his stepdaughter. These girls, or women, were best friends, but went their own ways after the gala, never getting in touch with one another. Money plays a large role in the attempt to unravel the case of Betsy Powell. Robert offers each of them an astounding amount of money in addition to what the production company is proposing. They all agree to participate in the series, which will be moderated by a popular television personality. Things are very uncomfortable for everyone who gathers at the Powell estate, including the housekeeper, and a pair of blue eyes are keeping close watch on all of the happenings. Mary Higgins Clark has been writing for many years, and her books keep getting better. The suspense she manages to generate will keep readers up all night. Her writing style is always approachable, her characters are finely limbed, and her plots are believable. I've Got You Under My Skin is a shining example of all of these strengths. And it's by Mary Higgins Clark, reviewed by Barbara Lipkin Kirschenbaum in April of 2014. Our final book today is Don't Talk to Strangers by Amanda Kyle Williams. In the woods of Whisper, Georgia, two bodies are found, one recently dead, the other decayed from a decade of exposure to the elements. The sheriff is going to need help to track down an experienced predator, one who abducts girls and holds them for months before ending their lives. Enter ex-FBI profiler and private investigator Key Street. After a few weeks, Key is finally used to sharing her downtown Atlanta loft with her boyfriend, Police Lieutenant Aaron Rouser. Along with their pets, they seem almost like a family. But when Rouser plunks a few ice cubes in a tumbler and pours a whiskey, Key tenses. Her addiction recovery is tenuous at best. Though reluctant to head out into the country, Key agrees to assist Sheriff Ken Meltzer. Once in Whisper, where the locals have no love for outsiders, Key starts to piece together a psychological profile. The killer is someone who stalks and plans and waits. But why does the sociopath hold the victims for so long? And what horrible things must they endure? The book is Don't Talk to Strangers by Amanda Kyle Williams. And that's all for this month's edition of Heard Any Good Books Lately. I'm George Douglas. I hope you enjoyed it. If you'd like more information about how to become a patron of the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped, simply Google or search on the North Carolina Library for the Blind or call toll-free 888-388-2460. You can also use those same numbers to join the Friends of the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped. It's that wonderful organization that sponsors this monthly feature on books. This program is intended for a print and visually handicapped audience. Heard Any Good Books Lately is available as a podcast right after the broadcast. See you next time.